This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McKee. Top aides to U.S. President Joe Biden have begun talks with a group of moderate Senate Republicans and Democrats on Biden's proposed $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief package. The talks come as Biden faces increasing headwinds in his effort to win bipartisan backing for the initial legislative effort of his presidency. Lawmakers on the right question the wisdom of racking up bigger deficits. Those on the left are urging Biden not to spend too much time on bipartisanship when the pandemic is killing thousands each day and costing more jobs. One key Republican, Senator Susan Collins of Maine, said afterwards she would reconvene a bipartisan group of focus on more targeted packages. Two White House officials say that President Joe Biden on Monday will formally reinstate COVID-19 travel restrictions on non-U.S. travelers from Brazil, Ireland, United Kingdom, and 26 other European countries that allow travel across open borders. The official spoke to the Associated Press on the condition of anonymity to discuss the upcoming order. Rioters have set blazes in the center of the southern Dutch city of Eindhoven and pelted police with rocks at banned demonstrations against coronavirus lockdown measures. Officers responded with tear gas and water cannon and arrested at least 55 people. Police in the capital of Amsterdam also used a water cannon to disperse an outlawed demonstration against the lockdown on major square ringed by museums. A video showed police spraying people grouped against a wall at the Van Gogh Museum in Eindhoven, 125 kilometers south of Amsterdam. A central square near the city's main railway station was littered with rocks, bicycles, and shattered glass. This is VOA News. Federal law enforcement officials are examining a number of threats aimed at members of U.S. Congress as the second trial of former President Donald Trump nears. That's according to a U.S. official briefed on the matter. Part of the concern is ominous chatter about killing legislators or attacking them outside of the U.S. Capitol. The threats and concern armed protesters could return to the Capitol have prompted federal law enforcement officials to insist that thousands of National Guard troops remain in Washington in the coming weeks. Trump's Senate trial on a charge of inciting a violent insurrection is set to begin the week of February 8th. The center-right incumbent candidate has won a resounding victory in Portugal's presidential election. Marcelo Rebelo de Sousa captured 61% of the vote Sunday to serve a final five-year term. He had widely been expected to win. Devoted most of his victory speech to COVID-19 pandemic, saying his first thoughts went to his victims and its victims, and promising to work for an economic recovery once it was all over. The socialist candidate Ana Gomes came in second with 13%, but close behind was a third, Andre Ventura, a newly arrived right-wing populist, whose 12% was a stunning development there. Israel announced the opening of an embassy in the United Arab Emirates on Sunday, just over 4 months after signing an agreement to normalize relations with the Arab Gulf monarchy. Israeli authorities said their embassy, which is housed in temporary offices, will promote the full spectrum of relations between the two countries. Israel has announced in recent months agreements to normalize its relations with four Arab countries, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco, under the sponsorship of former U.S. President Donald Trump. In the wake of this wave of standardization, many trade agreements have been signed between the United Arab Emirates and Israel in the agriculture, food, tourism, and high technology sectors. The Kremlin on Sunday accused the United States of interfering in Russia's domestic affairs and downplayed the scale of the weekend protest when tens of thousands rallied in support of jailed opposition politician Alexei Navalny. More than 3,500 demonstrators were detained in protests across the country on Saturday, and several injured in the clashes with police in Moscow following Navalny's call to rally against the President Vladimir Putin's 20-year rule. The West has widely condemned the harsh tactics used against demonstrators. More at VOAnews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Monday, January 25th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Will the Uganda High Court free Bobi Wine from house arrest today, Monday?
I know that the judiciary has no power just like any other institution, and no matter what the court says, I know that the ministry will continue behaving the way it is behaving.
Sudanese are planning more protests this week over bread and fuel shortages. Kenya's COVID-19 vaccine task force concludes rollout plans. COVID-19 claims the deaths in 48 hours of two Zimbabwe cabinet ministers. And today is showdown day in the Democratic Republic of Congo's parliament over the fate of the prime minister.
There are only two ways out now. Either he resigns by himself, or if he does refuse to resign, then he will have to appear in parliament and the congressman will vote against him, in which case he will be dismissed.
And the WHO expresses concern that Ethiopia's Tigray conflict could lead to the spread of deadly diseases. Those stories plus Tamsi O'Malley's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Uganda opposition presidential candidate Robert Chakulai, also known as Bobi Wine of the National Unity Platform, NUP Party, has called on Ugandans not to recognize the re-election of President Yoweri Museveni. Wine, who has been under house arrest since the January 14 presidential election, said the power resides in the people of Uganda and not him. He says Ugandans must exercise their power through nonviolent means to assert themselves. Wine's lawyers asked the courts last week to order his release from house arrest. However, Wine tells me that the Ugandan military continues to hold him and his family incommunicado.
First of all, I want to apologize for my bad connection. There's a helicopter hovering over my compound, and it is disconnecting all the phone lines. All our official phone lines are disconnected. We had to smuggle this phone line in, but I know that it's also being interfered with. The regime is intending to cut me off from the rest of the world.
What reasons did they give you for continuing to be under house arrest?
There is no rule of law whatsoever. They are not giving any reason. They are not allowing any journalists. They are not allowing any dignitaries, not even ambassadors. The U.S. ambassador will stand away at my gate. Members of parliament are turned away and some are beaten. My party officials are turned away. Even family members that try to bring me food are being turned away.
How are you and your family surviving? How are you making it?
Well, the last time that my legal team was able to accept me, they brought in some food and we've been surviving on that food. But now we have run out of food. But the military and the police will not hear of it.
The spokesperson for the government said it was important for you to be under house arrest because they think that when they let you out, you will lead protest against the election.
We are governed by the law. If I am doing anything illegal, I should be arrested and charged. And if not, I should be let to be free.
Now, they're supposed to be ruling on Monday about your detention. What are you expecting, Honorable?
I know that the judiciary has no power just like any other institution. I know that Uganda is run on the orders of Museveni. And no matter what the court says, I know that the military will continue behaving the way it is behaving. We have called upon the international community and the United States, because they are the biggest players of the Ugandan military, to call General Museveni to order and to hold them to the values that we all signed to, the values of the rule of law, respect for democracy, which was outrightly disrespected by General Museveni on the 14th of this month, and also to respect my rights as a human being and as a citizen of Uganda.
The question, Honorable, that many people continue to ask is, what happens to Bobi Wine now that the government says you lost the election?
What the Electoral Commission announced was a fraudulent announcement. It was fake. It was not real. It was not anywhere related to what actually the people of Uganda said through their vote on the 14th of January. We defeated General Museveni resoundingly, and we have evidence to that. I am supposed to be the legally and the democratically elected president of Uganda. But unfortunately, I am being detained in my house by the military because the dictator fears the people and therefore cannot allow me to communicate with the people.
Honorable Bobby Wine, what's your message to the people of Uganda, particularly those millions of people who voted for you?
My message to the people of Uganda is that the power is in your hands. Right now, I'm being held a captive by the military because General Museveni thinks that the power of the people of Uganda lies in me, which is not true. The power of the people of Uganda lies in themselves. And you can also stand and defend your victory. You can defend your voice. I encourage you not to recognize General Museveni and to use all non-violent means and ideas to assert your voices and to defend your will, because what General Museveni did is carrying out a coup against the people of Uganda. Dictatorship and tyranny must be resisted, and it must be resisted by all Ugandans of goodwill.
Robert Chakulai, also known as Bobby Wine, was the presidential candidate of the National Unity Platform Party in Uganda's recent election. He was speaking with us from his home in Kampala. Today is showdown day in the Democratic Republic of Congo's parliament over the fate of Prime Minister Sylvester Ilunga Ikunkamba, an ally of former President Joseph Kabila. Ilunga has been prime minister since the election of President Felix Tshisekedi 2 years ago because Kabila's party holds majority in the 500-member parliament. But last Friday, the parliament gave Ilunga 48 hours to resign or face a vote of no confidence. Tshisekedi's party has been in a coalition with former President Kabila's party since 2019. But recently, Tshisekedi said he had found a new majority. Noel Shiani is the leader of the Forces of Change political grouping and a former presidential candidate. He tells me that Prime Minister Ilunga will have to resign because President Kabila has been almost like an albatross around President Tshisekedi's neck for the past 2 years.
Well, what it means is that this prime minister has been in office since almost since a year now, and his appointment as prime minister was based on this power-sharing agreement between the Front Commun pour le Congo, the Common Front for the Congo, led by President Kabila, and the Cap for Change, led by President Tshisekedi. So those two had an agreement whereby the prime minister had to come from the Kabila side. After a year, it had become very clear that the coalition was not working and was not meeting the challenges faced by the country and the population. President Tshisekedi had his hand tied up to the point that he couldn't decide. The country was not being managed properly. So he had this consultation with the population, different groups of the population. After that consultation, it became very clear that the population wants him to get out of that agreement between the FCC and the CASH.
Now, Prime Minister Ilunga was given 48 hours as of last Friday to resign. Today is Monday, should be the deadline for the 48 hours. What happens if the Prime Minister does not resign?
Well, normally, I suspect if he does not show up, the congressman can still note his absence and vote in his absence against him. That's one option. But the second option is that President Tshisekedi has the power to appoint a new prime minister, and by signing a decree appointing a new prime minister, that decree abolishes the previous decree which had, or the ordinance which had appointed the prime minister Ilunga Ilunkamba, because you cannot have two prime ministers. So I believe that Ilunga Ilunkamba, the current prime minister, has no more choice. He has to either resign, accept to go voluntarily, and if he doesn't, the parliamentarian, whether he shows in parliament or not, the parliamentarian will vote against him and he will be dismissed.
There was some information on the social media about the presidential guard and whether securing the home of the prime minister. Is this true? And if that is so, what do you think will be the reaction of the Kabila side?
Well, I heard those things on social media. I'm reluctant to comment things which are not official news, which are just speculation on social media. People have been saying that in case the prime minister does not accept to resign or to appear in parliament, his office, it's not his house, but his office will be secured by the presidential court. That's what I read on social media. I don't know if that is true or not. I cannot comment on something which is just a speculation.
Why do you think now that President Tshisekedi feels the need now to separate from President Kabila?
Well, the need to distance himself from President Kabila arises from the reality that over the last 2 years since President Tshisekedi became president, the coalition has kind of tied up his hand. It was impossible to take any decision without referring to Kabila.
Noel Shiani is the leader of the Forces of Change political grouping in the DRC. He was speaking with us from the capital, Kinshasa. More protests are being planned for this week in and around the Sudanese capital, Khartoum, over bread and fuel shortages. Khalil Musa, a former Sudanese diplomat, says the end of government subsidies has made basic commodities such as bread and fuel unaffordable for the ordinary people.
The basic feature of the project is the lifting of the subsidization that the government is not supporting any kind of services or basic needs, especially bread and gas. The price of bread in Sudan right now is tripling. It is from 2 Sudanese pounds to 4 Sudanese pounds. The gas also is very high, and also, I mean, the cooking materials as well. So for that, people are protesting every day. And I think they're planning for the big gathering and the big protest to be after tomorrow on Wednesday. This is a message to the government that the citizen, the normal people cannot afford to pay for these services and these prices. And they are asking the government to intervene first to stop lifting the subsidization, especially on the basic needs and medical drug, on bread and gas as well.
The economic crisis caused the protest that brought down former President al-Bashir. Now, can you explain what does it mean when they say that the government has decided to change the criteria for determining the selling price of bread to be based on the kilogram instead of the loaf of bread? What does that mean?
Means one thing, that is the government is no longer sustaining or the price. They are not providing an assistance to the normal people affording to buy the food, the bread, because one piece of bread right now is 4 Sudanese pounds, which is beyond the financial capacity for any normal family, even middle-class family. They cannot afford that, especially in the urban areas, in towns, cities, and urban areas. And the government is no longer giving subsidization for that. They don't subsidize the bread. They don't subsidize the medical drugs and medication. They have not subsidized the oil and gas. So, I mean, the government is withdrawing. And this is basically the prescription of the IMF and the World Bank. Sudan cannot borrow any loan from the World Bank, from the IMF, unless fully lifting the subsidy, the basic needs. It will be by the normal mechanism of the market. The social unrest is expected to expand.
The issue of fuel and gas, is it because there's the lack of fuel or gasoline, or because there's a lack of foreign exchange? What is responsible for shortage of gasoline?
The government policies, they relate that, refer back to the market balance and the market power. Right now, the international price, the Sudanese people is buying the gas and oil according to the international price, which is very metric. Every time is fluctuating. Right now, in the last week, they increased the price of the oil and gas, and the international market, if the international market goes up, then the local prices in Sudan goes up as well.
Khalil Musa is a former Sudanese diplomat. He was speaking with us from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, January 25th. The World Health Organization is warning that conflict in Ethiopia's northern Tigray province and the consequent disruption of health services could lead to the spread of deadly diseases there. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Ethiopia's November military assault on Tigray has caused a major break in the humanitarian pipeline there. The United Nations estimates that over 4.5 million people, about half of them children, need assistance. The World Health Organization and other agencies have been granted only limited access to the region. WHO officials who recently visited the area say many hospitals and clinics are only partially functioning. Healthcare workers have been displaced and essential services disrupted. WHO Health Emergency Officer Teresa Zakaria warns the disruption of essential health services has severe consequences for the population, particularly children.
From January to November last year, over 400 cases of measles in children were reported. With disruption to routine vaccination, this number may increase significantly in the near future. Over 9,000 cases of malaria were recorded, and when compounded with malnutrition, the fatality due to malaria among children can increase up to threefold.
WHO reports the incidence of COVID-19 in the Tigray region is higher than the average for the country. Up to November, more than 6,700 COVID-19 cases and 47 deaths were reported. Zakaria says COVID-19 response activities initially were shut down and have been slow to pick up, posing a major health risk. She says referral hospitals cannot accept patients with serious conditions. This, she warns, could lead to a surge in preventable illness and death if health services are not resumed immediately.
With most disease prevention activities interrupted, and based on what we know of past history of outbreaks, the risk of spread of COVID-19, measles, cholera, malaria, yellow fever, and meningitis is very real. And other health conditions are also left untreated. However, without a functional disease surveillance systems, we are not able to gauge the epidemiological situation and we are flying blind.
WHO says, with the help of other organizations, it has been able to send needed medicines and supplies to health facilities in Tigray, but much more needs to be done. It is calling for greater access to the region and for more financial support from donors. To date, it has received less than half of the $9.8 million it says it needs for its humanitarian operation. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The government of Kenya will this week receive recommendations from an 11-member vaccine advisory team on the COVID vaccine rollout that is expected to take place in Kenya soon. Task Force Chair Dr. Willis Akwale says the team has already concluded the plan and put in place factors to ensure the vaccine has been approved by the World Health Organization and registered in the country. As Marie Ojiambo reports from Milwaukee, USA, the vaccine distribution comes at a time when Kenyan health workers are being on strike for 3 consecutive weeks.
Kenya has adopted a phased approach to issue the vaccine that will be supplied by different pharmaceutical companies as Pfizer vaccine becomes the first one to be administered in Kenya. According to Dr. Willis Akwale, chairperson vaccine advisory team in Kenya, the country will have 3 phases in administering the vaccine that will be issued with both government and private health sectors.
In the first phase, we are targeting frontline health workers and what we call essential health workers. We are looking at policemen, we are looking at the military, we are looking at immigration officers. So these are going to be the group that would be in the first phase that is going to run between January and June. And then in the second phase, we are going to start targeting the group that is 58 years and above.
Those present in the meeting that was concluded yesterday, Sunday, were representatives from World Health Organization, Red Cross, AMREF, and Ministry of Health directorates. Dr. Akwale said the team has also ensured there will be health officers who will follow up in case there will be reports of the vaccine side effects.
There are a number of minor side effects, but as part of the rollout, there are 2 things we are going to do. We are going to monitor adverse events. We've got registers and we are working with our pharmacy and poisons board that will be monitoring any of the side effects and report. and this will be recorded through a system they have developed known as the pharmacovigilance system. Additionally, we have recommended the setting up of what we call safety monitoring board that will go out and monitor any of those side effects that will be reported.
According to experts, the government of Kenya has been quite reluctant to publicize the vaccination. They have not prepared people to take it, neither have they involved the community leaders, without whom the community will be hard to convince. Most of the people in Kenya think that COVID-19 is a hoax, and the officers in charge of issuing vaccination might find it difficult. Mr. Kwale, however, says the government's plan is to ensure there is equity in vaccination.
Our plan is to ensure that there is access and equity across the entire country, that anybody at risk who wants to get the vaccination has that opportunity. And our vaccination sites will be spread across all the counties in Kenya. We will not concentrate in an area just because it is reported to be having high cases, because as you know, also testing has not been equal.
This rollout comes at a time when health workers in Kenya are still on strike. However, the ministry says the strike by health workers will not hinder vaccine rollout. Kenya's Health Cabinet Secretary Mutahi Kagwe earlier said that no Kenyan will be forced to take the jabs. The main objective of the task force is to dissect issues like vaccine hesitancy, county government engagement, vaccine depots, cold chain storage and logistics, and immunization records, as well as donor interest, among other issues surrounding Kenya's preparedness. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Milwaukee, USA.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with a look at the latest updates from the 2020 CHAN tournament. Host Cameroon reached the quarterfinals of the Total African Nations Championship after playing out a 0-0 draw with Burkina Faso on Sunday. The result of the Group A clash at the Amadou Ahidjo Stadium in Yaoundé means the Stallions crashed out of the competition as they finished third in the group. Mali finished top of the group with 7 points after defeating Zimbabwe 1-0 in the group's other game played at the Japoma Stadium in Douala, also on Sunday. Cameroon finished second with 5 points. Burkina Faso was third with 4 points, while Zimbabwe ended bottom of the group with no points. Zimbabwe captain Sibanda Ariel says despite their exit from the tournament, they weren't a chance to add to the numbers.
We didn't come here maybe to add numbers, but we came here to compete also. We are still competing. We haven't lost hope because we know the nation is looking at us. We have to get something and make them. For us to go home, we have to go with something so that the nation can be proud of us.
Zimbabwe coach Vaska Logarochik blamed their exit on lack of adequate time to prepare as a result of COVID-19 pandemic restrictions back in Zimbabwe.
Our government gave us green light to play football somewhere in the December. And then we had only half of my players, we had 10 training sessions. Less of half players, we have less than 5 training sessions. That means most of us, we played, we have about average 7 training sessions, including games, and we came under such a big competition like this.
Mali and Cameroon will advance from Group A, but will have to wait for the outcome of Monday's Group B matches to know their opponents in the last 8 of the tournament, exclusively designed for home-based players. In all the matches played this past weekend, Zambia needed a late Spencer Sauto goal to end a 1-1 draw against Guinea in Group D on Saturday. The result means both Zambia and Guinea maintain their places at the top of the group with 4 points apiece, having won their opening matches last Tuesday. Milutin Sredojevic is the Zambian national football coach.
The game could go either way. And exactly the way game is so funny, tricky, unpredictable.
Zambia will play Namibia in their final group game
game at the Limbe Stadium on Wednesday, while Guinea will travel to the Stade de la Unification in Douala to face Tanzania in the matches that will be played simultaneously. Staying with the CHAN tournament, three women referees created history on Saturday at the African Nations Championship. Ethiopian referee Lydia Tafese and her assistant Malawian Benatida Kwibira and Nigerian Mimsin Iyohe all became the first women to officiate a match at the Senior CAF Male Tournament. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, January 25th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing that you will have a great week.